Yeah. All right. Welcome to Freethinker Radio. I think everybody can hear us. Welcome to Freethinker Radio on 90.1 KPFT Houston and the Conscious Resistance Network. My name is Derek Brose, and I'm here with Micah Jackson. Those of you who listen on a regular basis, you're probably familiar with our show. We broadcast weekly through YouTube, through Facebook. We're live on Float right now. And we also air this on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. So me and Micah, and usually Johnny, are here to co-host with us, but Johnny's not here this week. But we got a lot of stories to cover. So while Micah gets that ready, I'm just going to go ahead and dive. We are going to be talking a little bit about some Houston news. Of course, I was based in Houston, Texas. Micah is still based in Houston, Texas, and the Freethinker Radio Show is based in Houston, Texas. And we've got a number of stories related to Houston today to get us started. Some of them are going to be related to COVID. Some of them are going to be related to police. This one Mike is going to cover, so I'm going to step aside on this one just because I know that he really wants to talk about this. He likes to talk about the school issues, which I think is important for people to really understand the insanity, the depravity that happens in the public school system. So we'll let Micah get to that one. But this story here, it's an update on the Tuttle raid, the Harding Street raid. This is the husband and wife and their dog who were murdered by HPD officers almost 2 years ago now. And it was covered up, initially tried to cover up, and so much has come out. We've been covering this since the beginning, since January 2019. And the family of the woman, Regina Nicholas, who was killed in this raid, says the city owes them a full explanation of what happened. The family says that she was killed during the controversial drug raid, and this was January 28, 2019. Relatives have now filed a brief asking the Supreme Court to force an end to the 19-month cover-up by the city of Houston. Attorney for the family claims the city does not have any legal precedent to withhold the testimony and evidence from relatives. Attorney Patrick Doyle asked, "What is the city so desperate to hide? Houstonians deserve to see what HPD did before, during, and after the out-of-control and unjustified attack on Regina at her home." Regina's brother, who I've talked with before, and I've aired footage of this on this channel, John Nicholas, said, quote, "Our family search for the truth of what happened to Regina will continue no matter what. Once again, she did not deserve to be executed in her own home, on her couch, by the Houston Police Department. The mayor and chief of police owe our family an explanation of what happened in the raid. And with Narcotic Squad 15, fighting us is not the answer. We are not going away." And this is just the latest in a long line of revelations that have come out showing that what is the police officer's name? I want to make sure we keep his name alive because it's important that these people be outed, the officers, though they don't even name the Gerard something. I can't remember his name. And he was the main officer who lied on the warrant. He made up all kinds of information. And it results in these people dying. They were called drug dealers. And I mean, it's just been going on for some time. And so it's an issue that is important to those of us who are from Houston. It's an issue that's important to those of us who are basically trying to hold police accountable. And I want to bring Mike on now, see if we can get Micah's stream working. Yeah. I was just kind of wrapping that up and just telling everybody a little bit about that. And I know we've been following that. And, I want to say this just as a brief aside, Micah, before we go further, because I saw this comment in a video I did the other day. Somebody said, they kept asking, "Are you anti-police? Are you anti-police?" Because I was talking about a story like this, you know, talking about holding police accountable. And that was the sort of dichotomy that they wanted to frame it. Like, are you anti-police because you're talking about violent things police have done? And I just want to make it clear that I don't think Micah's anti-police. I know I'm not. And Freethinker Radio isn't. KPFT isn't. Conscious Resistance isn't. But we definitely are anti-violence and anti-people who lie and who steal and you do this on taxpayer dollars and who rape and do all the different things that we've covered that police do get away with often because of their badge and their special privilege that they have in society. So I just wanted to make that point.
I think you bring up a secondary point is that they're more susceptible to temptation because of the extra privileges that they're given. Nobody's anti-police. Like you said, you know, they're just anti these violations, and good police would be anti these violations as well. I think that's the core of the problem and what has to be sorted out. It's difficult because just like they have extra privileges, you can expect the media and rights groups to have a special eye on them, you know, because they should hold themselves to a higher standard, at least to a certain degree. They should at least obey the law. So when they are coming out lying and such, it gets a bit rough. I know we got a lot of Houston news, and some of it has to do with the police as well. So I guess I'll just keep moving, because there was this one, and it was in the news, and I'm not sure if we covered it before or not, because I didn't remember the name of Pamela Turner.
Yeah, let's roll into that.
This Pamela Turner, I actually got this off of reading in Yahoo News, but it turns out it was right here in Harris County. You know, I just kind of stepped on it going, what's this? Police officer kills this woman. And it's a horrible video. I watched it. A Texas police officer was indicted this week in the death of a black woman who was killed outside her apartment more than a year ago. An incident that drew national attention and left the family of the victim demanding answers. It turns out a Harris County grand jury returned an indictment Monday charging Baytown police officer Juan De La Cruz with aggravated assault by a public servant in the death of 44-year-old Pamela Turner. It turns out she had, they say at least, that there were, you know, she had some mental issues, things like that. But if you watch the video, I don't think anything really can help justify it, the shooting of her. The decision comes after a year-long campaign by Turner's family members and supporters for justice in the case. So you see how hard these families have to work afterwards to just, you know, even, you know, get the word out or vindicate the family or get, you know, maybe a killer cop held accountable by, you know, the police. The news that my family received on Monday is the exact reason why we have not stopped calling my mother's name for the past 16 months, Turner's daughter, Chelsea Rubin, said in a conference Thursday. I prayed for this very moment numerous times, and I prayed that my mother's death would not be in vain and that she gets the justice that she deserves. And this is what we hear so often from the victims, and I guess few other victims, because the families are also victims because they lose this loved one, you know, oftentimes an innocent loved one, or maybe a troubled loved one that didn't deserve to die. Nonetheless, Turner was killed on May 13th, 2019, as Officer De La Cruz tried to arrest her at Brixton Apartments in Baytown, a city about 30 miles west of Houston. A video clip that partially captured the incident showed what appeared to be a verbal confrontation between Turner and the officer, which then quickly escalated into a scuffle. In the video, and I think that's what's important, these are such short periods of individuals' lives, like half a minute, a minute, you know, 5 minutes, and they're this bad for both, you know, the officer and the victim, or the person that's killed, whatever you want to call them at this point. In the video posted by local media, Turner is shown arguing with the officer, saying, quote, I'm walking. I'm actually walking to my house, she said, adding, you're actually harassing me. The officer then attempted to subdue her and appeared to discharge a stun gun. The physical altercation between the two continued until Turner was brought to the ground, at which point, as she said to De La Cruz, you're actually harassing me. Why? Why? As De La Cruz again fired his stun gun, Turner told him, I'm pregnant. Moments later, five shots are heard being fired from De La Cruz's gun. Police said Turner was not pregnant. Initially, police alleged that Turner grabbed De La Cruz's stun gun and used it on him. In May, however, Houston Public Media reported that the model De La Cruz used, the X-26P, can't fire a second set of darts, according to documents it obtained from the city. De La Cruz's attorney told the public media that Turner still could have used the stun gun on De La Cruz, even if it had an empty cartridge. Cagle did not respond to a request for a comment to update, you know, where they stand on that. An attorney for the Turner's family said the video showed that Turner, whom he describes as mentally ill, appeared to be trying to get away from De La Cruz. And this is what you see in the video. No action of Ms. Turner's was to go after the officer. And anyone who watches the video can see the truth in that attorney statement there. It was always in an effort to get away from him. Think about this. So he fires these five bullets at this female laying on the ground in front of him, looking up, trying to get help.
I just played the clip there, Rebecca, for everybody who's watching. Right.
So, yeah, you know, I mean, this is what's happening. On Monday, Baytown police said that a series of events unfolded which led to Officer De La Cruz discharging his duty weapon, resulting in her death. So I guess, you know, this is one of many stories, and it goes on for more ground than I've covered thus far. But we've got a lot more going on in Houston, you know, with so much with the Tuttles and that and others. We just only have so much time to go, you know, through. Civil rights groups are, demanding change. And I think that's important to note. We are at times, this could work for many people from different walks and different persuasions, but it turns out that, you know, all these civil rights leaders have been stepping up. We've seen it through the news. We see it everywhere, but not in Houston. An activist says there's not going to be these changes here. We have yet to take any decisive action, De Leon says, as far as criminal justice reform efforts in Houston. Instead, we decided to wait. De Leon and other civil rights groups on Wednesday renewed calls for the mayor to make serious reforms to improve the city's public safety. Citing recommendations from the Justice Can't Wait report released earlier this summer by the ACLU, Texas Appleseed, Houston Justice, Black Lives Matter Houston, and other local and state organizations. City officials are preparing to unveil a cite and release ordinance Thursday, which that did happen. And Turner's Police Reform Task Force is expected to release its recommendations for the coming weeks. During a Zoom news conference, activists called on Turner to enact a cite and release ordinance that prevents police officers from arresting defendants accused of citation eligible offenses. So, you know, that is one thing that, you know, can be some positive. I think yeah. They're pushing for a lot more than that. And I, you know, I would expect so. I looked at some of the cite and release and some of it, you know, I don't know if you want to get into that real quick, but I saw that it's not just for like victimless crimes. Some of it is criminal mischief of up to $750 in damage, graffiti resulting in up to $2,500 in damage, and flat out involuntary theft of up to $750, theft of service worth up to $750, and bringing contraband into a correctional facility and driving with an invalid license. So, you know, this is a wide array of things. I think, you know, it's a lot more than what people often think of with, you know, things that can be cited and released. But maybe, you know, maybe you have different feelings about, you know, these offenses, but nonetheless.
Well, I want to say, Micah, that I think that this is an important part that we should take note of, is that for all the talk of, you know, police reform and the protests this summer and everything, that whether or not you agree with some of the things being proposed all across the state of Texas, the city of Austin, which is, of course, seen as the most democratic or liberal city in the state, is the only one that really even talked about taking away some resources from the police. Everybody else seems to have buckled down. We know that in Houston, they gave them almost $1 billion. Same thing in San Antonio and Dallas. Like, the efforts mostly failed, other than small superficial reforms like this. And one of the problems that the civil rights leaders that you were just talking about were mentioning is that the mayor is basically saying that he's unlikely to renegotiate a contract with the Houston Police Union. And of course, many people with the police department, and many people see that the unions, Houston Police Officer Union, are a big part of the problem. And that you have in some cities where the district attorneys are now starting to, I don't want to say face off, but they're definitely aware that one of the biggest roadblocks to police reform or police abolishing or whatever your goal may be, let's say ending police killing as just a simple goal, is the police union. I mean, we've seen this, right, Michael, with the last shooting that just happened in the last couple of weeks or so, or with the officers getting fired for Nicholas Chavez, that immediately they come out and they defend their officers no matter what. That's their role, I guess. So they're doing what they're supposed to do. But if the mayors are unable or unwilling to even act as it, like, you know, they can go march with people just like the mayor and the chief did. But at the end of the day, there's no real reforms offered. You know, they can go out there and Acevedo sheds tears, but nothing's really going to happen if they don't address the control that the police union has.
I think that there's some things that maybe we could talk about would be reasonable expectations in a response from the police union. And I think it should be something along the lines of a, you know, compassionate, law-driven response, you know, that we're taking a stand that we don't know until this day in court happens. And, you know, we're going to stand beside our officer, and people would expect that, right? But sometimes I think what the problem is that some of the statements that we've seen come out a little bit less law-abiding than that, at least in what seems, you know, to most people, general decency or whatever. I mean, when we heard things like don't talk about the tunnel raid, you know, and that sort of stuff, when it was obvious what was going on, I think. But yeah, nonetheless, I do think it's important that you brought up that contracts.
You want to go jump into this school story before we move on to some COVID news, like local Houston COVID news? I know you had this school one.
Yeah, I kind of thought this was interesting because it has a couple of memes going around. And I'd just like to get into the bullet points. They say as of Friday, 11,029 students were unenrolled from HISD. Because they did not log into virtual learning at all since school started Tuesday. So I thought that in itself was an interesting aspect. But when you get further into the story, it also says that the TEA told the news for every student that doesn't show up to class, HISD, quote, could lose an estimated $9,200. You know, it's like assuming like they have it, they're going to lose it. Like they're going to go to the school and take $9,200 from them already. And I really don't believe that's what's happening. If the district doesn't recover those students who are unenrolled when the official count is taken in early December, that could cost this district, cost them. Like they're going to somehow generate productive income and pay this. That could cost the district an economic loss of nearly $101.5 million since in Texas, school funding is tied to attendance. I don't know what else you really could tie school funding to, but it's an interesting story, you know. So they're talking about, look, because all these students aren't going, you know, this is another effect of the politicians' choices in reaction to COVID. I mean, this is just like the biggest ripple through everything. So I don't know, but that's about all I really wanted to talk about on that story. I do think there's a lot more information in there, and there's probably stuff like this going on in school districts all around the country.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, we covered so much. I know that that's sort of your specific beats on the schools of everything that's going on there, and whether it's I like the way you put it that, you know, they act like they're going to lose money when the school doesn't produce anything, the government doesn't produce anything. It's all coming from taxpayers anyways. So, but that's sort of the way they conflate the arguments by, oh, we're going to lose money. We're going to lose money. But at the same time, I would say just while we're talking about schools, man, just from talking with family and some people online, like people are definitely second guessing keeping their kids in the public school system. I think there's a lot more people who are now considering homeschooling or unschooling because of either some of them are afraid to send their kids back to school. They don't want them to be near people or whatever. Others are like, look at the way they're treating the kids. They're putting them in bubbles. They're putting boxes on their heads in some cities and some states and countries. And then still others are doing the school thing at home via Zoom, but they don't really like some of the practices that are going on. I don't know if we've really touched on this in the past weeks, Micah, since school started, but some of the schools have told parents that like, parents and, you know, other family members aren't supposed to be in the room during class because it's supposed to just be a student safe environment. There was a tweet that kind of went viral where this one teacher was basically complaining that he wouldn't be able to talk to his kids about race and sex and gender without parents or other people in the room, you know, kind of overhearing. And also there was this video in the last week. I learned about this. There's this thing called Brain Pop, and it's like designed for kids. They play it at school. I'm sure the kind of things that some of us had at school in different ways, maybe for the same purposes that we didn't realize. But this particular Brain Pop is like a fake news program that they play for the kids, and it's all cartoonish. And this one that just came out, Anthony Fauci, of course, is the lead infectious disease expert here in the United States, is how he's propped up. He's on this Brain Pop being interviewed by the cartoon, you know, news broadcaster and telling the kids why vaccines are good and why, you know, there's anti-science and some people don't trust them, but make sure to remind your parents and just all this kind of stuff, man. And it's been interesting because I see people who typically maybe were a year ago more trusting of the school system are starting to think, for all the reasons I just said, or some of the reasons I just said, about taking the kids out. So I had to actually talk to my sister and she said, yeah, the kids are watching these Brain Pop videos. And so, I mean, it's, I don't know, just something to think about as far as there's so much going on with school and there's so much changes as we're pushing into this new normal or the great reset or whatever they want to call it. So many aspects of our life are changing.
Yeah, that's for sure. I hope everybody is doing what they can to build themselves up and to build the people around them up. I'm thankful for KPFT giving us the opportunity to and the music, etc. So thank you, KPFT. And thank you, everybody that has ways of building themselves up, whatever that means. And
sorry about that.
Now's a crucial time for that in the face of all this. I think you're right. Where do you want to go from now, Derek? I think I've hit all the local that I had. Are you ready to move on? Do you want to go to music?
Yeah, so let's do this. I definitely have one more Houston story that's just a brief story that's going to tie us into some jump into COVID kind of national stuff. And then, Micah, we can, I know you've got some stories on the new ruling from the Pennsylvania judge. We've got talking of federal ID systems. I've got a new article about that Earn It bill is back, trying to break encryption. And then both the United States, the UK, and Australia are all three implementing some pretty tyrannical authoritarian measures in the coming months involving tracking people related to COVID and so much more. So we're going to cover all that, but let's just go to a quick song and try to get back on the groove. I'm going to throw out some of our friends, Lion Among Men. This is called When the Smoke Clears. Hopefully it plays all right. And you're listening to Freethinker Radio with Derek and Micah. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Freethinker Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston and the Conscious Resistance Network. My name is Derek Burrows. I'm here with Micah. What's going on, Micah?
all kinds of stuff's going on. I thank everybody for tuning in. We got a strong episode today. I mean, we've got so much news to get out. I really wish we had a 2-hour show because we got so much music to play and so much news to get out, but let's get to it. So you want to get into what's next? I saw a little bit of that flow, but you lead the way and let's go.
All right. Well, let's do it. So again, you're listening to Freethinker Radio with Derek and Micah. We're missing our buddy Johnny this week. But I do want to also, before we move forward, let you guys know if you're listening via 90.1 KPFT Houston, last week we had a special 9/11 episode, but there was some mix-up and it didn't get to the station on time, so it did not play on air, which is was most important for us, for it to play across Houston on the anniversary of 9/11. But if you go to kpft.org and you look up the archives, you can find Freethinker Radio from September 11th, and I really highly recommend that because we covered a lot of important news last week that you didn't hear if you're listening through the radio. But also, we had a special interview with the founder and architect behind Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, discussing some really important information. But now let's continue. We're going to talk about COVID-19, of course, for a moment. And this story is actually an update on something I've been talking about for the last few weeks. Right before I left Houston, you'll remember, Micah, I attended a press conference in Houston to ask Mayor Sylvester Turner and Houston Health Authority Dr. David Peirce about some of the concerns around the COVID-19 numbers from the Texas Department of State and Health Services. And I also had a chance to ask Houston Health Authority Dr. David Peirce about concerns around the test that is used to detect COVID-19, which is known as a polymerase chain reaction lab test. And this is something that we've talked a little bit about last week. I'm not going to get too deep into this, but I will say that this article can be found at The Last American Vagabond. And it is simply called, "If the PCR Test is Unreliable, Why Are the Health Officials Demanding the Public Be Tested?" Because at that conference I went to, the mayor, Sylvester Turner, and Dr. David Peirce, they continued to say, we need people to get tested, and we need people to get tested. And then when I talked in the hallway with Dr. Peirce and asked him about the concerns of the PCR test, he admitted that there were some concerns. And I'm just going to quote from that interview. We played it last week or the week before. Dr. Peirce says that when labs report numbers of COVID-19 cases to the city of Houston, they only offer a binary option of yes for positive or no for negative. Quote, but in reality, it comes in what is called cycle threshold. It's an inverse relationship. So the higher the number, the less virus there was in the initial sample. Some labs report out to 40 cycle thresholds. And if they get a positive at 40, which means there is a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of virus there, that gets reported to us as positive and we don't know any different. And then he goes on to say, quote, because if you test me and I have a tiny amount of virus, does that mean I'm contagious, that I'm still infectious to someone else? If you are shedding a little bit of virus, are you just starting or are you on the downside? And he believes the answer is there needs to be a national standard for this cycle threshold problem. So I thought that was interesting that as I was asking those questions here in Houston and talking about that on Freethinker Radio, this story went international because it's not about just setting a national standard like Dr. Peirce would like, because in that case, you might end up with one national standard for how the PCR test should work in the US and somebody could be rendered positive in that country. Then they could go to an entire different country with a different standard and be found not positive. So it could get very problematic. And most recently, Professor Carl Hennigan of the, he's from University of Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine. Him and the University of the West of England did a review of 25 different studies where virus specimens had positive PCR tests. And they did this new review called Viral Cultures for COVID-19 Infectivity Assessment. And they basically say that the test is so sensitive, it could be picking up fragments of dead viruses from previous infections. We mentioned this last week, I think, briefly. But Dr. Carl Hennigan said the same thing that Dr. David Peirce told me here in Houston, quote, a binary yes-no approach to the interpretation of the RT-PCR unvalidated against viral culture will result in false positives with the segregation of large numbers of people who are no longer infectious and hence not a threat to public health. So in the last couple of weeks, he's really been going hard on this issue. Dr. Professor Carl Hennigan, who is a doctor and still a professor as well, and he's also the editor of BMJ Evidence-Based Medicine, he also pointed to the problem of this binary approach that Dr. Peirce talked about. And he's gone on further, basically, and just they're calling for all the labs to kind of stop testing for the moment until there is what he said, a threshold for a positive result at the limit of detection. So basically, he's trying to say, like, look, instead of some labs having their cycle threshold, which is just you know, the it's when they stop testing, say they do it at 30 cycle thresholds or 40 cycle threshold, depending on that number, depends on how long you test for and whether or not you're picking up fragments of a previous coronavirus infection or some totally different infection that could be false. And Dr. Hennigan is actually the person that we talked about back in July when the UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock first had to call for an urgent review after Professor Hennigan showed in a different study that there was a statistical anomaly that was counting COVID cases that were not accurate. And at that time, you know, there was a quote from that story said, "You could have been tested positive in February, have no systems, then hit by symptoms, then hit by a bus in July, and you'd be recorded as a COVID death." So Professor Carl Hennigan has been talking about this for quite some time. I also saw just days ago, September 8th, he tweeted out another different study from his own called SARS-CoV-2 Testing, the Limit of Detection Matters, where the same thing, these other researchers say the same thing, that they need to have some sort of standard, that they could be picking up false positives in a number of different ways. And Hennigan also recently said to the BMJ, "One issue in trying to interpret the numbers of detected cases is that there is no set definition of a case. At the moment, it seems that the PCR positive result is the only criterion required for a case to be recognized." And he goes into why that's problematic, saying, quote, "We are moving into a biotech world where the norms of clinical reasoning are going out the window. A PCR test does not equal COVID-19. It should not, but in some definitions, it does." And finally, he says, quote, "This is a huge problem because politicians are operating in a non-evidence-based way when it comes to drug interventions." And so he's specifically pointing out like how many people are getting locked down or quarantined or whatever based on these false things. And as we're going to talk in just a few moments about all the crazy stuff happening in Australia, I mean, you could see why this could go wrong. So I know I just said a lot, Micah, but I'd love to hear your thoughts and see what comments we got there, because I think this is a developing story. And as I said last week, why are there no other journalists in Houston asking these questions to the mayor and to Dr. David Peirce about the PCR test? Why is there no sort of, I don't see any of this talk on CNN while they're saying like, hey, the whole test that we're pushing on everybody is unreliable, as they still demand more testing?
I don't know. I think the information is so jumbled, what we're getting out of the mainstream and lamestream on this. It's just like, how do I put it? I saw that the numbers that we were talking about here in Houston on, I think it was the last show or the show before last, I think Johnny was talking about it. But I saw that made a New York Times article, you know, and I'm like, why is it in the New York Times? But nobody here in Houston's really was talking that much about it. I don't know. I wish I knew the answer to that one. And I do think that it's good that the word's getting out. I think that more and more serious questions are arising, countering the perpetually shouted narrative of, you know, how dangerous it was, like, you know, it was the plague and the stand and we're all going to die if we touched anything, which I think it's important that, you know, that we have these different things that question it, because
how this connects to the next story.
Yeah. What are we going to get into? Is it the, that's what I was going to ask you. That's it for sure. I thought this was interesting, and I'm glad you've got that one. I actually closed it and pulled up a different one, but it's the same story. A federal judge has struck down, some of Pennsylvania's coronavirus restrictions as unconstitutional. And I think that's important that we have judges that are actually putting forth this argument, because, you know, it's just ideas. You could disagree with them, but if you can prove something's different, then so be it. It turns out that he said that the closure of non-life sustaining businesses was unconstitutional. What does that mean as far as we go into fall? People are questioning that and concerned now. Federal judge ruled that forcing businesses to shut down entirely and the governor's stay-at-home order were both unconstitutional. Basically, I guess, you know, with freedom, you know, comes responsibility. Some business owners say they've been waiting to hear a ruling like this for months. "It actually brings tears to my eyes," one said. That's how the owner of Giovanna's barber shop, imagine being a barber, that's how he reacted in Delaware County after the federal judge agreed with them that Wolf's business shutdown order was unconstitutional. Will this lead the way throughout the nation? Who knows? Maybe some of these petty tyrants will be shown some things. You might remember Giovanni's defied the shutdown order amid the pandemic and reopened in May. "We didn't have any money coming in from anywhere. It was awful. We were closed for 10 weeks. My barbers were starving." You know, they feel responsible for some of these smaller businesses to the people that work with them and for them. The judges ruled that Wolf's stay-at-home order was unconstitutional as well. In a 60-plus page opinion, the judge wrote, quote, "There is no question that this country has faced and will face emergencies of every sort. But the solution to a national crisis can never be permitted to supersede the commitment to individual liberty that stands as the foundation of the American experiment." I think that's pretty powerful and pretty important that he said that. A lot of things he put in place don't have to be in place. State Senator Collison said the stay-at-home and business shutdown orders the judge ruled as unconstitutional have already been suspended, but the judge did not make a ruling on restaurant restrictions, which are still in place. The owner of the quotations restaurant in media calls the rules arbitrary. "My customers are good customers. They're not going to walk into a crowded restaurant with 150 people here." The ruling also does not touch the Wolf administration's mask order. The court didn't say that they were constitutional. The court just didn't answer those questions. So I think this is, you know, an interesting ruling, and we'll see, you know, how people react across the country.
Yeah, I just want to say, Mike, I think that's also, I mean, I think that this is generally a step in the right direction, but at the same time, it's also a cop-out, I feel like. If the judges basically, when they shy away from making strong rulings on things that are obviously important, you know, in some instances they might, okay, we're going to rule this unconstitutional. Others are like, we're just not going to make a ruling. And I feel like that's at the least, you know, it's a dereliction of the duty of what a judge is supposed to represent, right? It's supposed to be this impartial force to interpret the law, well, or to you know make sure that the law is being upheld as it's passed. And sometimes I think that judges step away from it, you know.
Yes, for sure. And that's why I've kind of stressed this one, because maybe it's not a complete solution, but it's a direction heading in the right direction as far as the stay-at-home order and closing down businesses. So, I mean, never before have we seen anything like that.
Absolutely. Well, you're listening to Freethinker Radio here on 90.1 KPFT Houston and the Conscious Resistance. We're going to continue with you for about another 15 minutes or so. I just wanted to mention this one, and Micah's got an important one on the Patriot Act. And it's also reminded me, I don't know if you saw that headline, Micah, about the former somebody that worked for the NSA is now joining the board of Amazon. I mean, it's just corporatism all around. And this is just a reminder. This is from back in early June. I just wanted to retouch on this for a moment. The CARES Act, which was the stimulus bill that everybody made a big deal about a couple months ago, and I know there's some new coronavirus relief package that they're debating now, and it's supposedly going to help you. They sent you a $1,200 check, but millionaires and billionaires got far more from the government through this corporatism and this statism. It says the stimulus checks were meant to get average Americans through the lockdown, but those $1,200 payments were small change compared with the billions in tax breaks the CARES Act handed out to the country's wealthiest. And that's coming from an investigation by ProPublica. That's all I really wanted to say on that. And unless you got something to say, Mike, on that, we'll jump to the Patriot Act.
Yeah, for sure. Let's get into this. And this is from the Mint Press News, which is an interesting site full of all kinds of stuff. Turns out that Patriot Act co-author Michael Chertoff touts more election security as federal ID system looms. Called to overhaul the legacy bureaucratic systems of the United States with cutting-edge AI-driven mass tracking and surveillance technologies are intensifying at the top echelons of the national security state, with all eyes on the 2020 election. I thought this was really interesting. Keeping in line with the trend of governance consolidation taking place among current and former members of the American political establishment, such as the recent love fest between ex-president George W. and liberal elites, Michael Chertoff, once Bush's DHS secretary and co-author of the Patriot Act, along with two of his DHS peers, sat down at an event hosted by the Atlantic Council on Wednesday to call for a, quote, stepped up response to election threats. Janet Napolitano, have you heard that name before? And Jay Johnson, both former DHS secretaries under Obama, joined Chertoff in endorsing the findings and recommendations of a report published by the hosts, Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security, titled Future DHS Project. The study was sponsored by the Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, a military intelligence contractor with close ties to Michael Chertoff's DC-based security advisory firm, the Chertoff Group, and CenturyLink, a defensive telecommunications contractor, which was just awarded a disputed $1.6 billion contract to manage core networks and access services for the Department of Defense. The trio of former DHS warned that, quote, Russia, China, and Iran are actively interfering in the 2020 U.S. elections, as outlined in an assessment issued by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in August, which reportedly contains, quote, detailed evidence of the alleged interference. Janet Napolitano, who last June stepped down as president of the University of California, where she was directly implicated in the creation of a $175 million secret slush fund, said that the intelligence on Russian interference was quite clear and urged Trump to ramp up international sanctions and deterrence. Chertoff, for his part, dismissed the president's ability to do anything about the purported Russian interference because of credibility issues, and instead called for state and municipal authorities across the country to implement voting security measures themselves, such as new options for voters to cast ballots, a federal ID to save us all, at a virtual collaboration event that was taking place simultaneously and organized by FedID, the, quote, U.S. government's annual identity conference since 1995, Gay Gilbert of the Department of Labor's Office of Unemployment Insurance delivered her remarks about, quote, the perfect storm for a federal ID system. Gilbert, a 10-year veteran of OUI, is in charge of processing unemployment insurance claims, which skyrocket as a result of Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, from an average of 200,000 over 6 million a week. According to Gilbert, billions of dollars are walking out the door under these programs due to identity theft, adding that other agencies are going through the same thing. The severe strain, I think we have some other solutions. The severe strain imposed by pandemic response legislation and a stalled economy on U.S. bureaucratic institutions is opening the door for private sector companies like SAIC and CenturyLink to undertake the massive overhaul of its legacy systems to integrate emerging cloud-based AI-powered governance and security structures. Michael Mosier, Deputy Director and Digital Innovation Officer at the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network of the U.S. Treasury Department, said that due to, quote, billions of compromised credentials swimming through cyberspace, there is, quote, a very high likelihood that a lot of users in the U.S. financial system have had some sort of information about themselves compromised at some point. The solution to these problems, they continue to assert, is a new federal identity management system. This new system, it'll be better than the last system. Trust us. Who gave you the last system? Don't look. Underpinned by a federal digital ID. So I hope you're ready for it.
Yeah, and you covered a whole lot there, Mike, and I want to remind everybody that article is coming from mintpressnews.com. It's called Patriot Act co-author Michael Chertoff touts more election security as federal ID system looms. I mean, it just shows that we are really dealing with this national security surveillance state, biosecurity state, more people are talking about in the age of COVID. But I think it's just so important. For some people might remember, and I know you probably do, Micah, that Chertoff was the one who had stock in the body scanners prior to 9/11. And then after, when those started rolling out in the airport, it was like, oh, look how convenient it is that Chertoff in the Bush administration, another person in the Bush administration, is financially benefiting after 9/11. So I just want to make that clear again. And we're winding up now for the last few minutes. We do got a couple more that are related to the insanity with COVID-19. But I mentioned something briefly, and I just wanted to put it out there. It's former NSA chief joins Amazon board of directors. General who oversaw the NSA surveillance collection joins Amazon's board of directors. And I just think that, that's nothing else really needs to be said. This is the state of things in the United States, where you have people working for the national security state, the surveillance, the intelligence community. Then we have Amazon, companies like them, developing facial recognition technology, as well as Google and others. And the generals and the military men, much like the Monsanto board of directors, go in and out of the FDA and those agencies. And in the FCC, you have the cell phone companies going and revolving door with that. Now you've got private You've got government intelligence agents and generals going into the private sector to join tech companies that are kind of working on their own private surveillance. So, I mean, I just think that's an important note. One other brief note that I wanted to mention is that the Earn It Act that I know we talked about a couple of months ago, and I know there was people who were concerned about this a few months ago when it was first introduced, it is back now. And this is being this is a press release we're looking at from the Center for Democracy and Technology. It says, Civil Society Coalition condemns Earn It Act for threatening free expression, encryption, and child abuse protections. This is really disturbing. The Center for Democracy and Technology led a coalition of 26 civil society organizations in urging the U.S. Senate to reject the fundamentally flawed Earn It Act, Senate Bill 3398. This bill would result in online censorship disproportionately impacting marginalized communities, jeopardize access to encrypted services, and risk undermining child abuse protections. The Center for Democracy and Technology has warned of the threats since the bill was first introduced. And Emma Alonzo, who's a director with the Center for Democracy and Technology, says, quote, dozens of organizations are coming together to warn the Senate that it risks repeating the same mistake Congress made in passing the SESTA-FOSTA bill. The Earn It Act is a blunt tool that will result in platforms taking down a lot of First Amendment protected content, particularly content created by people whose voices are already marginalized in society, maybe like people who question COVID-19, although I doubt that's what they meant. The Earn It Act revokes Section 230 protection for internet intermediaries for a broadly defined set of criminal and civil claims around child sexual abuse, opening providers up to criminal and civil sanction for transmitting content that they did not create themselves. This revocation dramatically expands the risks of lawsuits that online intermediaries will face over user-generated content. And this just goes on. And basically, you know, if you want to learn more about this, go look at cdt.org and you can find out more. Just search the Earn It Act and find out more about that, because apparently it's on the horizon. It's being discussed. And this is, we've been talking about this since 2010, Micah, that the FBI has been saying for years that they need to crack encryption because only terrorists and criminals use encryption, and Americans shouldn't have access to certain kinds of encryption because it makes it harder for them to spy on us. And I think this is just sort of a continuation of that push towards breaking down any sort of privacy protections that Americans might choose to have. Now, the last three stories are a set here. I'm just going to briefly run through them, and I'd like us to talk about this for a moment, Micah, because I'm sure you got thoughts. This first one I found on Zero Hedge, and it's not really directly related to COVID, but interestingly, it's related to the push to hold immigrants accountable and that immigration debate, which a lot of people on the right wing, conservative Trump supporters, were really embracing while not recognizing how they were pushing and supporting the surveillance state and the police state. This one says that the Department of Homeland Security is proposing a massive expansion of, quote, biometric modality collection. And this was posted, a 328-page draft of a new rule being proposed by the Department of Homeland Security. They posted a, quote, notice of proposed rulemaking that outlines how the agency could grow its collection of biometrics data by at least 2 million submissions annually. And they're proposing to amend DHS regulations that, quote, concern the use and collection of biometrics in the enforcement and administration of immigration laws by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Customs and Border Patrol, and ICE. And some of the key points about the rule, it says that unless waived by DHS, any applicant, petitioner, sponsor, beneficiary, or individual filing or associated with an immigration benefit or request, including U.S. citizens, must appear for biometric collection regardless of age. So anybody who's applying, petitioning, sponsoring, benefiting, or in an individual filing or associated with an immigration benefit or request, including U.S. citizens, which aren't immigrants necessarily, must appear for biometric collection. These new biometric modalities include iris scans, palm prints, and voice prints. DHS may require DNA results to prove the existence of a claimed genetic relationship. Foreign nationals who are granted immigration benefits will be subject to continued and subsequent vetting and biometric evaluation until granted U.S. citizenship. New forms will be produced, including the new biometric requirements. So according to this new rule change, it could expand biometric screenings from 3.9 million per year to 6.07 million, which would raise it from 46% collection rate to over 70%. So just letting people know that's on the horizon for the U.S. And then more specifically, yeah, that's the new normal, right? I mean, and I think also when it came to the Trump supporters and the debate around immigration, he was talking about a wall, but a lot of people didn't understand that there was also talk of what they called a digital wall, or a biometric wall that wouldn't even necessarily be a physical wall, but it would be, you know, totally facial recognition cameras, thumbprints, biometrics up and down the north and southern borders. And now we're seeing that roll out. These last two are from Australia and the UK. This is from the Australia website, theage.com.au. People who refuse to self-isolate could be detained under proposed Victorian law. New powers to detain people considered a high risk of negligently spreading COVID-19 are set to be debated in state parliament this week. This was a couple days ago, so we'll have to see by next week what the update is. The Victorian government could also enlist protective service workers, work safe inspectors, to enforce public health directions under the proposed law, which extends one-off changes. So they're basically, they said this back in April, hey, we want to have this new emergency law. This is now, let's extend it for another 6 months and let's add some more powers to it. And it's interesting that this omnibus emergency measures bill proposes new powers the government says it will need to strengthen the state's pandemic response, including broadening the types of government employees who can act as authorized officers. So it sounds like they're deputizing more bureaucratic employees to go after others. And the article specifically, it quotes from the health minister in Australia, Victoria, and talks about family courts. I mean, there's really so much to this omnibus bill. And the article specifically mentions conspiracy theorists and says, like, conspiracy theorists who spread false information or who refuse to be, like right here, it says, the rules confirmed by to the age by a state government spokesperson could be applied to conspiracy theorists who refuse to self-isolate or severely drug affected or mentally impaired people who do not have the capacity to quarantine. So I'm sure there's all kinds of ways that that could be abused and misused, especially because we've been covering the insanity that's already taken place. And if you guys remember from 2 weeks ago or the last couple of weeks, I know we played it a few times, that police officer in Victoria talking about roving cops and breaking people's windows because they wouldn't tell them where they were going. That's this same place. Now they're preparing to, self-isolate people who detain people who refuse to quarantine and self-isolate. And we already saw that in the U.S. They put an ankle monitor on somebody, a couple in Kentucky. Final story here. UK government released they have a new bill that's going to go into effect on October 1st. It gives them the ability to retain fingerprints and DNA profiles of COVID-19 infectees under national security. It's titled the Coronavirus Retention of Fingerprints and DNA Profiles in the Interest of National Security Regulations 2020. And just gives them the legal, you know, bureaucracy that they need to say that they can retain your fingerprints or your biometrics that they gain through the process of testing you for COVID-19. This could be fingerprints, it could be DNA profiles, and they can store them for national security. And apparently it's a part of their Counterterrorism Act. And, you know, it says the second condition is the final day of the period for which the fingerprints or DNA profiles may be retained will fall on a date during the period that starts with the 1st of October. I mean, it's just bureaucracy. The point is now they're giving themselves the legal right of way to say, hey, if you're in the UK and you've been tested and we happen to gather fingerprints in the process or some of your DNA when we stuck that swab up your nose, well, we own that now and we get to hold on to it for whatever, you know, whatever purpose. Oh, it's insane, guys. It's insane. Micah, what do you think?
Yeah, it's pretty serious. You got to think, if they're going to take that information and hang on to it for national security, what are they going to do later? You know, why do they want to know? Oh, so they can go visit everyone, or they can say, oh, and he was, in addition to having bad ideas, he also had COVID. I mean, really, I think it's some of these things we hear, these, I guess, we shouldn't be surprised about tyranny in Britain, but nonetheless, I do think we see it rising up everywhere, and all these stories are just stand to it. And it's encroachment, you know, it's that old frog in the water until you bring it up to a boil. It just sits there and doesn't do anything. And we're seeing a lot of that. And this thing's turning up fast. Yeah, I think that we should have also talked about Assange. I mean, they won't let Amnesty or what is it? Yeah, Amnesty International monitor or anything.
I mean, it's yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Assange. I just want to say one other thing on that last story. That look, this is happening in New Zealand. It's happening in Australia. It's happening in the UK, and it could definitely happen in the United States. I just want all of our audience listening, especially those who are going to hear this on the radio in Houston, when we're describing these, you know, bills being passed in the UK and Australia or bills being considered in the United States. You know, don't doubt for a second that this couldn't happen to the United States. With the amount of people who are afraid, we've tried to point out some of the flaws in the COVID narrative. We're not talking about conspiracy theories. We're talking about legitimate professors and scientists and doctors who are questioning some of the things going on. And so we want you to question that and also to think about the outcome. And, you know, should we just be allowing these power grabs, knowing that there's all these different things going on? And now let's do take a moment, if we can, before we end for today, to mention Julian Assange. I do want to just say, everybody who's hearing this on Friday on 90.1 KPFT, I want to invite you to visit thehoustonfreethinkers.com. That's our website for Freethinker Radio. And last week, Micah, I interviewed Tarak Haddad, who you might remember we had on the show 6 months ago. He's the former Newsweek journalist who left after he tried to write about Syria and his editors were basically getting in his way and holding him back from writing the full story. Well, he's been reporting for the last 2 weeks at Julian Assange's extradition hearing. This week is the second week. Tomorrow it wraps up, and I'm going to interview him again this weekend. So maybe we can play some of that next week, or we'll post it on thehoustonfreethinkers.com. But as Micah said, the point is there are so many people right now who are calling out what is happening to Julian Assange. And there's people who say WikiLeaks is limited hangout or it's Russian propaganda or whatever. To me, it doesn't matter. If you can have those opinions, but at the end of the day, what's happening to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, this is setting a precedent for publishers of leaked information to be criminalized. And it's going to affect freedom of speech. It's going to affect journalists. It's going to affect publishers. No matter what it is, it doesn't seem like it's going to be good for freedom of expression at the end. Anything you want to add to that, Mike? I mean, it's just been crazy to see and to hear about.
It is. Yeah, it just seems to be an ongoing continuation of shutting out the voice. And, you know, you can think what you want, but I thought everybody should have the day in court.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, the thing is, like you said, doesn't everybody deserve a day in court and, you know, some real court, not a kangaroo court? Well, American citizens do, but he's not even an American citizen, and they're considering extraditing him from another country and, you know, holding him under American law without the constitutional guarantee. I mean, the whole thing is just, it's crazy. But yeah, we got so much more we could cover. We're going to cover next week with Johnny. Hopefully he'll be back. I know Johnny joined us late and said, dang it, I forgot. So we're without Johnny this week, but we'll be back next week. And I guess in honor of Johnny, Micah not being here, I wanted to end with some El Jumbotron and play Perfect. Nature's Revenge. Anything else you want to add?
We love you all. Thanks for all the support you give to the ideas and for building yourself up, because that's what we're going to need, everybody to be stronger in the face of this. And, you know, we all got different ideas of what that means. So let's make it work.
Absolutely. All right. Until next week, this has been Freethinker Radio. Micah, Derek here on 90.1 KPFT Houston. Peace.
Here's a short story about a dying hollow.